To those here rather than those not here for not having returned essay drafts yet. I was spent more time over the spring vacation being sick and also more time editing first-year student work than I expected. It's harder to be a first-year student than it used to be, and they're needier in really quite worrisome ways, but it did take time away from your work, so if you want to resent somebody, don't resent them, resent me. I'll get it to you by next week. The weekend should be sufficient. Of course, nobody needs to come because there's just two essays and I've got them on my hands, and why should they come to class? So thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. I'll try and produce sufficient value to justify your presence. We are still waiting to find out how much state power is going to be used in the network, by whom, to go along with the dying. And I don't know, and the moments we have spent discussing that question here from time to time are still valuable, but everything is still in suspense. As you know, the president told everybody to be worried about cyber attack before leaving for Europe. The comments I have made here about why consumer banking apps might be a useful place for a military to go to make trouble in the United States have not been disproved, but if anything, rather the opposite. But mostly what we're all aware of is that if there's two places on the street where are written in large letters children, and the ordinance has been delivered exactly in between those two signs, and what was there is no longer there, that whatever is about to happen to human beings in the net will not be ruled by kindness any more than what happens in Mariupol is ruled by kindness. So again, I recognize the inutility of comparison, which doesn't mean that there's an inutility to drawing correspondences. Human beings are either equipped with rights that force will acknowledge, or they're not. And those of us who have been associated with that cruelty and truth on the ground, whether we were at that time wielding force or having it wielded against us, we all know what it comes down to in that sense. The dignity of human beings is entirely dependent upon the willingness of force to acknowledge rights. Without that, human beings are reduced to animals who can kill and be killed. The subject that we're discussing is not as evidently tangible in that process as the forms of respectful rights that protect in the streets and the parks and in the schools. But only because not tangible, not because not present in the streets and the parks and the schools, not because not present in our homes and our pockets. Everywhere there is a boundary now drawn inside the self of the human being. Everywhere there is a boundary in which either there will be respect for rights or in the end there will be no dignity and there will be violence. The work that I do trying to understand how to maintain freedom in that technological environment, the work I do now, that's so what? The work that I started doing when I was 16 and have been doing one way or another ever since was based upon a young person's understanding that the world would move into that condition sooner rather than later. And that understanding was based in turn on an understanding which came out of two other experiences, one of which was growing up in the world of nuclear confrontation, in which our science fiction the imaginative literature on which we as teenagers were raised was all about the unintended consequences of technology and the power of technology out of the control of human ethics to destroy. That was the first element. And the second element was, I have no doubt whatever, that of being a Jew in America in the decades after the end of the Second World War. To know oneself to be part of a community, half of whose living members had died by murder. My great-grandmother starved to death in Leningrad during the 900 days, alongside her only daughter, who also starved. And I find myself, of course, at the other end of my life as aware of Mariupol as of Leningrad. I lived a little bit in one, and I didn't ever live in the other, but they are the same, because when starvation has been decreed against us, this is what we become. So that, I'm sure, also affected my concerns growing up and made me particularly sensitive, I have no doubt, in some way or other, to the recognition that the technology that I helped to make and whose philosophy I believed was one of liberation could just as easily become one of destruction. To say, now here we are, is really to say, now here we are back again. To recognize that the things that I thought of as forces that might have shaped what I had to say about the First Amendment and the net and the nature of rights and freedoms in a technological society, the things I might have thought of as stepping stones to that, or maybe I should say blood-soaked holes that we had climbed out of, are not gone in any way at all. All is superimposed now. And at that point, you know, I think that it should be easier to make my usual case. After all, I don't have to say this could happen again. I can just say, well, so you have Xinjiang, and you have Ukraine, and you have Hong Kong, and you can see some things. And you needn't bother with history too much. I say, standing here having spent weeks trying to get the First Amendment into now, out of its history, because that's my habit and my doctorate and what have you, and I can't help it. But I also think that this, like Darwinian understanding, is consilient. Many directions jumping together, as the Latin would have it. There's just many roads of approach to what is in the end the same reality. Without rights, without strength in human dignity that power can be compelled to accept, the combination of who we now are and who we have always been and all the places that we have stood in before should tell us what will happen next. A thing we never wanted to see again and are now seeing again and will see again in all your times, unless we figure out how to take with absolute seriousness the rights that power must acknowledge, lest human dignity perish. Okay, that's my welcome back from spring vacation speech. Anybody want to say anything? The stakes are high. I know that in law school there is something professional about lowering the stakes, you know. I mean, yeah, well, this is a thing you could make a living on. And I understand that advocacy is to a penny where we live. So it's a shame even to think about advocating as though it were, but I mean, I must, you know. The stakes are really high. The nature of human beings, our Ukrainian comrades understand, is worth fighting for. But that's not That in a way is the simplest of calculations. When power attempts to reduce your dignity completely and to remove your humanity, fighting back is the thing you have to do. It's getting several steps ahead of that, so that we have so embedded in the nature of who we are as people, as the human race, that it will be more difficult to do this next time. That we don't need to fight back, we need to fight first. We simply need to fight with rights rather than with violence and the destruction of human dignity. This is lawyer's work. This is, you know, we consider it honorable. And regrettably, we have to take it seriously. We can't be too flip about it, which is bad, because it's easier to lawyer when you don't have to treat the thing as a matter of your own life and death. So, I'm going to assume that I don't need to put the text of the First Amendment here, that it is in your minds, and that it's a sentence. Now, we have one idea: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition government for redress of grievances. One idea, though with several different parts, all of them originally speaking to the power of an empire now being built out of a federation, an unum e pluribus, but one in which there would be some limits, that the power of violence and the control of the army to conquer the continent could not cross. And then mysteriously, by an alchemy which, like so many other American alchemies, is only the confrontation between the reality of unfreedom and the aspirations of freedom, a struggle violent indeed, but intended in the end to increase the dignity of human beings rather than to reduce it. As a result of this odd American alchemy, what was a principle against the employment of legislative authority by the federal legislature, backed by the federal army, a guarantee of localities' ability to respect these dignities of human beings, their rights in their worship, and their rights in their speech and publication, and their rights in the use of their public places, it became a general proposition that no government within this constitutional jurisdiction, within this American empire, in fact, would behave in these ways, in not just in its legislatures, but in its police forces and in its courts, that no government here would behave in ways that confronted these elements of the human dignity that had been previously ruled only out of bounds to the feds. And that incorporated First Amendment without changing any of its words, but simply aligning with half an eraser, Congress shall make no law, that this First Amendment then acquires an enormous latent power. The power remains oddly latent, however, because there is so much that merely saying government shall not make a law about consumes the detention of the courts for decades. And in that time, when the First Amendment has to do with the little man and the cop, with the Jehovah's Witness, with the finer shouting about racial equality, and of all places, Buffalo, and getting canceled for it in the way that cancellation used to occur with rocks and beer bottles and bats, the little man and the power of the state, the heckler's veto and the fighting words and all that obscenity digression and all of it actually occupying only a portion of the conceptual space that is opened up once no government in this empire, on this continent, shall do anything that respects an establishment or prohibits free exercise or abridges freedom of speech or press or the right of the people to express themselves collectively. Once the charter is that big, the cases are in effect remarkably small. Because what is sitting there in this language now, a principle that there shall be no government assistance to, endorsement of, enforcement of that which abridges these rights, that's a lot of rolling rock. And we are in an odd way still waiting for the big shoe to drop. We know what the cases of the last 50 years have done, and they have done quite a lot. They've told us why, for example, you cannot have a state statute enforcing the teaching of creationism equally with evolution in the schools. I wasn't a fan of the way that the court decided Evans against Aguilar. I could have done a much better job, but it wasn't in our chambers, though it was at my elbow all its way. But whatever one wants to say about it, it's for sure true that the destiny of laws against teaching critical race theory in the schools has already been written by the Supreme Court. I'm not by any means suggesting that the cases under the great First Amendment of the later 20th century haven't lifted any weight or done any work. They have. But there are a whole range of matters which, now that we live in the society the network makes us make, are ripe for decision, not yet decided. After all, if there shall be no law, no extension of power to abridge the freedoms of speech and publication of the people, then sooner or later we must inquire why it is okay to license Rupert Murdoch to speak to 279 million Americans, and you and me to have such website as Mark Zuckerberg will permit us to have. Why it is okay to hand out licenses to Rupert Murdoch and the employers of Tucker Carlson to speak without a substantial restriction and to treat as prior restraint anything that may be done to interfere with their broadcasting, while also delegating to Mr. Zuckerberg the right to determine which of the things that appear on your website are allowed to appear there. If what was really implicit in the idea of no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press was to be taken even slightly seriously under contemporary circumstances, then it is obvious that those thumb on the scales movement by government are simply prohibited. The First Amendment of the late 1960s, that under which Red Line Broadcasting was decided, was a First Amendment which had not yet fully taken on that affirmative equalization principle that I'm now relying upon, but which sensed it. It wasn't that the court denied it. What the court said was that the fairness doctrine could be imposed on broadcasters because broadcasting was inherently something that government had to control, otherwise broadcasting frequencies and powers would be unregulated and we would descend into the cacophony and tragedy of the commons, etc., etc. And so, faute de mieux, because there wasn't any alternative to licensing of broadcasters, broadcast licensing was constitutional and conditions could be imposed on the license, including the fairness doctrine. What died wasn't Red Line Broadcasting, it was the Fairness Doctrine. Congress repealed it, the miracle of which was that we were enabled then to have Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, the two most important innovations in American journalism in my lifetime. But by doing that, by officially ascribing a role in subsidization to the Murdochs and the Carlsons and the shouters of the world, what was actually happening was an apparent neutrality replacing a real neutrality, unjustifiable for technological reasons, if technological necessity was the only thing that would justify the rule. And of course, we don't live in a world in which the way we use the electromagnetic spectrum requires us to have the government allocate it. On the contrary, since the beginning of mobile telephony and the mobile internet, we have, of course, been using the electromagnetic spectrum in a smart way that doesn't produce cacophony or collapse. And we have deregulated a large part of the spectrum by capital sale because there was no longer any need for government exclusively to control frequencies to prevent collisions, when smart devices could use packet-switched networks of wireless spectrum to achieve the ability to carry everything for everybody. They only delay a little bit in order to charge extortionate prices for that bandwidth, mostly charged to the poor. You and I, of course, do not pay for bandwidth what the poor pay for bandwidth. Right? We live in university environments, and we have high-speed wired networks in our homes instead of depending upon the wireless brokers to afford us the connection to the net that every human being needs where she lives as well as where she works. What we really did was to create a new system based around the idea that speech and press would not be abridged, only listening and reading. Now, there too, the amendment that came from the 20th century development was not conceptually blinkered or held in place, handcuffed to its wording, as the Fourth Amendment did. The court was aware in the 20th century sunny uplands of the First Amendment that the right to speak implied one way or another the right to read, that the right to publish implied the right to receive, though the court could never take it quite seriously enough. I suppose that Mandel's the case closest to the line. May the citizens of the United States, located in New Haven, Connecticut, and collectively referred to as Yale University, invite to come and speak to them one horrid Belgian communist, Bernard Mandel. And do they, therefore, have the right to compel, by virtue of their rights, the government to allow them to invite Mandel and to have him admitted so that he can come and speak to them? I made a speech this morning at 7:30 in Bombay. Such is the value of the 21st century. I used Zoom to do it. Such is the horror of the 21st century. It was the first occasion upon which I have used the thing called Zoom since before the epidemic. I violated my principle of no Zoom ever under any circumstances in order to give that speech. My hosts at IIT Bombay assured me that it was on YouTube by 9 a.m. Well, 9:30 anyway. I don't know. I haven't looked, and I don't. But I don't recommend. I mean, but it is of course correct that this is what every human being can do. And it would be deeply surprising, not really as surprising as I'm letting on, it would be deeply surprising if the government of India attempted to prevent me from arriving in Bombay at 7:30 via Zoom, or for my remarks to have come back out again and arrived at YouTube 2.5 hours later. It would make sense to say that I don't have any right to litigate that question in the Indian Supreme Court. I am, after all, truly, as Mandel is, a foreigner. But I am not dependent upon my right. I am not asserting my global right to mouth off at 7:30 a.m. about the platform companies and the parasite with the mind of God. What we are asserting is that for human beings to be taken as equal to one another, and for their rights of speech and publication not to be abridged, they must be able to listen to what they want to hear. And that which they could have said, they must be able to listen to. And there, the Supreme Court waffles because, well, as my predecessor at this lectern no doubt was saying earlier in the day, the president is exclusively committed under our constitutional system to the maintenance of foreign affairs. And obviously, the speech of a Belgian communist at Yale University, whether delivered virtually or really, implicates the foreign affairs power, possibly not as much as it implicates some other things. But thus the Supreme Court found itself a generation ago. If it were to face that same question again today, I would hope that it would be easier. I'm not sure it would be, but I would hope it. Because we, of course, have gone another step beyond merely the question of whether it is abridgment of the right to prohibit the listening or reading of things. We have come now to the question whether it is an abridgment of the right to surveil completely the reading or listening to things. Our 21st century First Amendment has to ask whether power is being used in an inappropriate, unconstitutional, unlawful way, not only when it is giving licenses to speak to Rupert Murdoch or to someone else at volumes unattainable by other Americans. We are now also asking whether it is in keeping with the dignity and rights of all Americans for some Americans to be watching everybody else read and listening to what everybody else says. This is hard. I agree it's hard. I mean, it's hard because capitalism is on the other side, and when capitalism is on the other side, everything is hard in American law. But this is the necessary question. It was the necessary question in Bombay at 7:30 a.m., and it's the necessary question here at 4:08. If we use the force of society, which necessarily includes dominantly the force of the state, its power to construct the economy, its power to regulate technology, its power to teach, its power to incentivize, and all of that. If we are to use the power of the state to build an information order of the 21st century, to what does that promise of the First Amendment commit us? On what road must we walk? Not merely which roads are closed, but which roads are required. It's clear that the United States government cannot construct an information order in the United States in which newspapers are licensed. We have 1,000 cases that say that. We don't have any cases which ask whether it is okay to be a publisher who is A, not legally responsible for the accuracy or potential for harm of what is published, but also B, is entitled to surveil every reader all the time. That's actually a more pressing question, isn't it? If half the newspapers in the United States surveilled all their readers and the other half didn't, is it right that the government's policies and treatments should be indifferent as between the two? Shame on the New York Times, of course, for having been all these years a newspaper that surveilled the hell out of all its readers. It's as though instead of being the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers, they were the Pentagon. But that passed largely unnoticed, or at least it was thought of as the noble Salzburgers doing what they needed to do in order to make the newspaper they owned viable in the 21st century. But, of course, it isn't just the Salzburgers, it's the United States. It's the deployment of the public force, which says we are indifferent as between newspapers that surveil their readers and newspapers that don't. Go ahead, knock yourself out. Is that an abridgment of the freedom of speech or of the press? Well, one of the questions, of course, will be, are the Salzburgers more the press than the people are? And this is why, as I've tried to show, the idea of the press as a constitutionally privileged subsection of society was a figment of the 20th century imagination. It was valid for its moment, to the extent that five justices of the Supreme Court might have believed it, but fundamentally neither part of the tradition nor of our present, in which the idea of the press as a specialized and important constitutional entity of its own is, I'm happy to say, ludicrous, and we won't believe it anymore. So what then is that information order that the First Amendment allows government to build instead of the one that it, however much the current cases do or don't fully acknowledge it yet, prohibits the government? At one level, this is, as it was this morning for me in Bombay, about the platforms, right? About these objects, actually, from my point of view, organs of the parasite with the mind of God, biological material, an entity we created in software, and which we now grow like a tapeworm in ourselves by feeding it. But let us call them the platforms anyway. Let's grant them their framing just for a moment. The platforms is for them what press was in the 20th century, a metonymy, technology containing intention. And let's give them that. They are that. They're not the press, as was called for by the First Congress, and they're not even the press, as was called for by the Sulzbergers and Potter Stewart. And they are still, as I said of Zuckerberg in 2009, rather a long time ago, they are still the people who did more harm to the human race than anybody else their age. But what is interesting to us, I think, what is important, whosever constitutional law we're using, in particular if we're using this one, what's really interesting here is that it is quite obvious that they cannot exist without the state. They're no more autonomous in that reality than any other form of business enterprise. And if they are growing freedom of expression, if they are contributing to freedom of the press, then even the way in which they do that must be not such as to abridge the freedom of others. And that's unattainable on their model. In the late 20th century, what I believed that everybody else didn't believe was that broadcasting was unconstitutional. I thought broadcasting was unconstitutional because I thought the differential favoring of some entities by orders of magnitude above the ability of others to communicate was not something the government was allowed to do, given the First Amendment that by the late 1970s or early 1980s we had. But what the fuck? I was just a law student. Or a clerk, or a young teacher, it really didn't matter. My view of the situation was obviously wrong, because the entire weight of received opinion stood against it. I'm not so sure that's true anymore. But once again, it's not that we're going to wind up in the Supreme Court voting 6-3 one way or the other on whether broadcasting is unconstitutional. Because the very thing that makes broadcasting unconstitutional, namely the presence of so much technological alternative that you can no longer say we do it this way because we have to, is now a force which is leading broadcasting to be obsolete anyway, right? It's the technology that rendered it unconstitutional which renders it immaterial. And so in the end, we'll move from the system created in the early 1930s to accommodate commercial radio, we'll move to a system which acknowledges that the net consists of common carriers. In a democratic administration, we can assume, after Tom Wheeler's FCC did it, that that's the general policy of half of the elected governments of the federal state, that everybody in the telecoms business should be a wholesaler of packets, moving them from A to B, and that parties who want not to be neutral, that want to control their own flow, cannot also control any portion of the infrastructure that moves packets around. We'll get there. I'm not sure that we'll get there this decade. That entirely depends upon the ebb and flow of presidential and congressional politics, but we can be sure that one coalition of the interest groups in this society will be consistently pushing in that direction until that direction of travel has been fulfilled. So we are not any longer now worrying about whether broadcasting is unconstitutional. The crazies got less crazy, but the issue got less important. In the end, we all sort of converged by 2035 or 2040 to something that was visible but not acceptable at the end of the 20th century, that lay outside the Overton window, as they call it now, 50 years before it happened. Now the really important question is, to what extent is the comprehensive surveillance of everything you read and see and listen to acceptable for government even to tolerate in a society which is committed to the idea that there shall be no legal process abridging freedom of speech or of the press? The platforms and democracy, totally inconsistent and mutually incompatible, period. Discuss. If I gave an exam in last term's Law and the Internet Society course, that would, of course, have been an excellent exam question. Government exercising enhanced social control through the surveillance of all reading and conversation in society by private market, privacy invasion, subcontractors, subject to subpoena and all other forms of legal process, compatible with democracy in no way, not at all, period, discuss. If I gave an exam in this course, that might be a good question. But we don't really have to answer the question. We have to ask the First Amendment to answer the question. Right? That's the terrain of the confrontation. That's where the action is. That's where on the map this question is going to be decided. Not, I am growing pretty sure, in my lifetime, but it's certainly in yours. There's a remarkable convergence between the attitude of Xi Jinping and the attitude of any president of the United States. The convergence extends as far as everything except whether the middle name of it is party. But with respect to almost all other details, the convergence is significant. Pretty much everybody has agreed that power is okay with the unlimited monitoring of the reading and private discussion of the people. I understand that "is okay with" covers a multitude of different sins, but my point, of course, is that from the legal realist point of view, they all reduce to "is okay with." That's a very broad consensus. I notice how broad it is because I notice that I'm almost the only person I know who isn't part of it. This is not okay. It's contrary to the idea of democracy that the First Amendment commits us to. There is a further broad general agreement that the analytics made available by collecting everybody's behavior are so socially valuable that everybody ought to support them. Whether that social value is described as social stability by the Chinese Communist Party, or is described as amazing new innovations in medicine and transportation and insurance and etc. in some other society, the confluence of desire, it's remarkably the same. Let us gather together everything everybody does and as much as possible of what everybody thinks and intends, and let's all study it for the benefit of everybody. Now, I mean, I understand why this isn't to be regarded as an obviously inhumane or disgusting or autocratic or etc. point of view. It is enlightened despotism at its finest. And it would be okay, I suppose, to have a conversation about whether enlightened despotism is a better despotism were it not for the fact that we have this sentence which tells us that we don't use law, all law, everywhere, all our law, we don't use it to abridge the freedoms that come from speaking and publishing what you want. So there is also a remarkable convergence on the other side. Not really very effective, but noticeably convergent nonetheless. The people I agree with least in the American political drama around me are also all upset about freedom of speech and control of press and publication by a few richly entitled people who live in the wrong states and have too much money and et cetera, et cetera. And it's remarkable how little we agree about while vehemently agreeing that this is true. Because what is being stated is not actually a political idea, right? It's a psychological revulsion to the discovery of loss of that form of control over one's thinking and speaking and doing what one thinks is appropriate as a citizen in an equal democracy that they too are experiencing, because it's true. Because it's real. Because no matter how much our social perceptions may be thought to differ, viscerally, that experience is now shared. And at that moment, there is, of course, a crisis of democracy pending. Yes, there is. They all keep talking about it, same as I do. Well, not same as I do, because they have completely different ways of thinking about it, and their remedies are apparently rather, simplistic, right? Nonetheless, what we see is the very kind of the political convergence which in a constitutional democracy makes constitutional change. Because not just one part of the constitutional, civil, or political society needs this change to happen, but because more than one part needs it to happen. Because whatever the differences are that democracy is having trouble bridging, there are shared perceptions underneath. It's not unreasonable for a historian or a sociologist or anybody else who understands that the future is unpredictable to predict the future here. Right? We don't know how it will happen. But we know that there is enough disquiet across the whole body of the society that sooner or later we will find ourselves discussing whether we have rights sufficient to restrain power in the presence of some super friends reading everything over our shoulder all the time. Maybe it will take a while before people feel as concerned about that inside universities as I do now, or maybe it won't. I don't think the universities are good at predicting when the upswelling of vehement opinion on the subject of student educational privacy is going to occur. I think they think the day is never. I think they're wrong, but I don't know when it is. So the question of the affirmative First Amendment, the question of the presence of a duty in government to use the public power in support of the people's rights, is the grand issue, the overarching strategic question of the First Amendment in your time. And while, as I have tried to submit to you, the great questions of the Fourth Amendment in your time will not be addressed by the Fourth Amendment, some of those same questions and a lot of the other ones that really matter lie within the purview of the First Amendment we already actually have, if not within the frame of the cases the Supreme Court has actually decided. Let's take a look at a few more of those segments of that area. The question of what it means that the rights of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for redress of grievances mean, what a principle against abridgment, which is affirmative in nature, means, remains to be determined. The the meanings ascribed in the 20th century First Amendment. The streets and parks belong to the people. There's constitutional limitations on the denial of parade permits. Businesses have a right to lobby government for redress of the grievance that their competitors are allowed to exist, etc., etc. All those are minor doctrinal shards. Because we occupy a society with a different set of spaces in it. The 20th century company town of Marsh Against Alabama, or even the 20th century shopping center of Logan Valley or Lloyd Against Tanner or the Prune Yard, those are spaces of importance in society, and they remain important, but they are progressively less and less important, where the role of the citizens in gathering online and in affecting government collectively by petitioning through processes of electronic government, all of which is totally unperceived in the 20th century, let alone the fruit of the cases, all of that is what our 21st century First Amendment must be about. It's easy for us to say that if the government of the United States said you go to jail for 15 years for calling what we're doing a war, we just want to call it a special military operation while we go and drop ordnance on other people's children, it's easy to say, yeah, they can't do that. That criminal law will not be upheld in the United States Supreme Court. 15 years for telling the truth is not a crime that the... Okay, good. We do know that. We do indeed know that. And we do indeed, therefore, understand that gathering in Lafayette Park across from the White House with signs on them, with signs that say whatever they say, is constitutionally protected activity. But there's a lot that we don't know, stretching back to the original beginnings of hacktivism. There's a lot that we don't know, and there's a lot of law we haven't clarified with respect to the right of the people to conduct, well, I don't know, denial of service attacks on American military or civilian law enforcement. And what is it about the denial of service attack arranged by the citizens which makes it so easy to think of as terrorism or obstruction, when urinating on the Pentagon was not? It can't just be that denial of service attacks deny service. That puts us back in the First Amendment of the early 20th century, where the silly leaflet by the unknown man is protected by the First Amendment largely because we don't believe that anything he says is going to make any difference. And of course, the first generation of hacktivists like my comrade Ricardo Dominguez, who conducted denial of service attacks on the Pentagon, they were ethical hacktivists. They delivered to the Pentagon advance notice that they were going to be conducting the attack, and they provided them with the source code they were going to be using, and that, because, of course, it was civil disobedience, a ritual, a symbolic way of proceeding of a kind that, you know, from everybody's point of view, ought to be regarded as a whole lot less terroristical than dumping tea in Boston Harbor. But we have not yet undertaken any serious constitutional thinking on these matters, and we will have to. And although I can always imagine cases which decide that X or Y is a matter of national security, or X or Y is a matter of the unfettered presidential power over foreign relations, it becomes hard, without some force majeure of that kind, to explain the constitutional principle clearly, and nonetheless to be determined that the streets and the parks belong to the people, but the networks belong to power, and thus it must always be. We are aware of the vulnerabilities that we have to the manipulation of the network by people who don't like our government. That's the whole fear we have at the moment about Tsar Vladimir and his hacker tribes. But on the other hand, if we're not ready to understand that electronic society, like the streets and the parks, belong to the people, and that they have every right to get out in them and to carry their signs and to stop traffic and to honk their horns and to behave as though they were free people, then we really haven't taken seriously the principle of electronic democracy, not at all. So sooner or later, there have to be cases. And cases have to ultimately confront the fact that without the dignity of human rights that can be limiting against power in the net as well as outside the net, then, well, there will be violence and there will be a loss of humanity. Anybody who doesn't believe that, there's Hong Kong and there's Moscow and there's Xinjiang, and knock yourself out. We are, after all, compelled to admit that in this country there are two Abrahamic religions which are acceptable and one which isn't. I don't mean in this country inside churches on Sunday where ecumenicism is always spoken and everybody understands that the Jews are hardly going to whip up anti-Islamic prejudice and slam it into their neighbors in new pogroms. But on the other hand, in the net we live in here, is it really true that we are managing perfectly to establish no religions and to interfere not at all in the free exercise thereof, but that we are listening to and reading everything said throughout American Islam all the time in ways that would never pass muster with the magistrates if it were an attempt to listen to Southern Baptism? So we have to, I mean, we don't have to, we can always not, but we should fess up. We should acknowledge how freedom doesn't work. And we should recognize that the world of our net contains an awful lot of what used to be just fundamentally unacceptable spying. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. It happened to all sorts of Americans during the Vietnam War, including my own family. But it certainly means that it wasn't supposed to happen then, and it's way too happening now. Fourth Amendment rules are not effective here. I've tried to explain why. I do understand why, at least in arguable force, we have neither legislated respecting an establishment of religion, nor have we prohibited the free exercise, but we have not in any sense enforced in our net the principle that how Americans worship has no effect on any of their civil rights. We can't say that. It wouldn't be true. We're going to need some cases. A lawyer who worked for me on technical rights work left my employ some couple of years back in order to go to work for the Council on American Islamic Relations. I was very happy with that. I thought that was terrific. It's only my pride and parochialism that compels me to say, and he's a Jew, but never mind. That we have a rendezvous with destiny about this. We're accumulating shame. Somewhere along the way, we're going to have to reckon with our impacted shame. Everybody in this room who has lived a lifetime in America understands that that may be a very long time we have to wait. It could be generations, but we have this nonetheless. And that we thought we were a nation committed to the First Amendment while we accumulated this shame is normal, standard operating procedure. As the greatest historian of the bloodlands of Europe in this generation, Timothy Snyder, said about something else not so long ago, sovereignty is the power to declare yourself innocent. And this, of course, is part of what the American Constitution does in fact do, right? It declares itself innocent of the three-fifths rule, and it declares itself innocent of the fugitive clause. And we too, like that, we use power that way, but the First Amendment is a rule against it. It's not its explicit subject. But the idea, which is that sentence, says, Congress shall make no law declaring us innocent. And of course, we did it anyway, and we continue to do it anyway. And in every generation, we can see where those controversies must ultimately fall. And here is yet another one. It's really hard to find a way to describe what the First Amendment is, if you back off from the Larry Tribe, clausified law school way of thinking about it. If you talk to the regrettably diminishing number of Americans who know what the First Amendment is and so on, and you ask them what it means, in the end, they will find their way to saying, well, it's about democracy, you know. It's about our rights to be in a democratic society together, to say what we want and to print what we want and to worship as we please and to go into the street as we see fit and necessary. And they'll be right. If there is a way of mediating between the power of the platforms and democracy in society, if I'm wrong, and there is such a way to do it, then the First Amendment is how we make that deal. And if there is no such way to do it, then the First Amendment is what ultimately dooms the idea of the platforms, the people who will let you read anything as long as they can watch you read it. Questions, comments, things to say up until this point? No? Can't be right. Pure, unbroken surface, in no need whatever to regard. Why? If there were a big case on the docket this term, could we talk about it? Is it that we're too far into the future after having been too far into the past? Why doesn't he talk about what the Ninth Circuit did last week? I mean, the past and the future, they are both in existence, and we glimpse them through this moment we call the present. Don't we? Okay. Very well. You sure? Gone once? Gone twice? Nah, we just don't care. We're not even bidding. So, if that's true, in other words, if all this is easy to swallow because we know it's got no nutritional content and it's not going to make us barf if we don't let it, then let's go just a little bit further and see if we can get to the point where there's actually some reflex in the throat. This desire to censor one another, you know, it's weirdly the outcome of the pervasiveness of the surveillance exercised by both the state and the market, right? The rational secret police want to remember everything you said to everybody for the last 25 years, right? The rational secret police want to have a magic button they can push. So anytime they're interested in you, they can push it, and everything you ever said to anybody suddenly becomes available to their analysts. And the rational secret police, therefore, might be assumed to love best the system in which everything is recorded and they're the only people who can listen to it. Like the Stasi in The Lives of Others up in the attic with the earphones on. At least you might think that if you were an English-speaking, European-descended person whose legal tradition, as I've pointed out, is pretty much about a tiny number of thugs doing very little to interfere with society in very targeted ways. But the minute that you're not that, the minute you're a secret police representing a political party of 83 million people ruling 1.4 billion people, let us say, that's not the rational way to behave at all. The rational way to behave at all is to make sure that everybody can find everything ever said by anybody and to encourage people to go out and deal with it on their own. You want to stimulate intolerance. You want to get your work done by the combination of the network and the masses without the intervention of the thugs. Then you can use the thugs for even better stuff. And of course, on this scale, in this sort of a society, you have as many thugs as you could possibly require. Even in a society like this one, if I could go that way with it, I recognize that I'm making an unnecessarily offensive comparison, but even in a society like this one, it is true that power finds it very useful to increase intolerance. And the machinery of the increasing of intolerance is the machinery of the surveilled conversation and surveilled reading, but not secret surveillance, but public surveillance. The endless substitution of automatic memory and automatic collection for the really otherwise unlikely, grubby, dismaying task of setting people to spying on one another. Let us conduct the spying in an antiseptic, universalized way. And then let us use the systems of so-called free distribution to encourage people to censor one another, to shut one another up. You don't have to be Tsar Vladimir in the United States to find that an attractive social strategy. Lots of people find it an attractive social strategy for lots of reasons, including just that they're selling on it. They're using polarization as a product delineation strategy. Persons of type A buy this powdered washing powder, and persons of type B buy this powdered washing powder, and on we go. And censorship of a private kind, not government censorship, but intolerance and efforts to shut up people one disagrees with, actually become brand loyal. Is government allowed to be neutral about this? I mean, obviously, government won't really be neutral about this. There's a whole lot of government that will be really happy about this. And there may even be some weeping, bleeding heart congresspersons who are against it. But the really important question isn't, is there politics on both sides, or is somebody standing in front of the television camera talking about it? The real question is, what is public policy? Is public policy contrary to polarization and in favor of democratic values? Well, the one government I know which is solidly, rhetorically in favor of using the network to create more democracy and to reduce social polarization is the European Commission, which is a completely undemocratic organization incapable of achieving its stated objectives. But they do recognize that they ought to be talking about it because, by God, this stuff really is a threat to democracy. The non-democratic rulers of the European Commission are well aware of this. And that too, is part of the global structure of how these senses of what the people's rights are have been moved. The clarity of the Chinese Communist Party's position is admirable. There's no ambiguity about it at all. the United States government, under its First Amendment and the rest of its constitutional regime, well, it's not as rhetorically clear, but its strategy is as limpid. The privacy invasion subcontractors, the platforms, the parasite with the mind of God, whatever you want to call it, is, from the point of view of the United States government, a great national asset. Pretty much in the same way that Xi Jinping would describe the Chinese net, but much more apologetically. A great national asset because it listens to the world, because it offers the opportunity to understand and shape opinion on a global scale, because the analytics are good, you know. In other words, this is the equivalent of what coal and steel were at the beginning, and petroleum and steel was at the end of the 20th century. This is the primary infrastructure of society, and the American companies and entities and structures are in on the ground floor of it and dominate the global view. And therefore, incumbency is of unlimited worth, and the American government is in favor of its own incumbency. And so it has little reason to rock the boat. But it must run its races burdened with the Constitution, unless it prefers to carry its Constitution proudly, which maybe we can say before the era of Snowden it used to do. I said in the Snowden lecture that every government on Earth had the same responsibility towards its own citizenry, to block spying from outside, and to subject its own listening to the rule of law. This could have been a relatively easy test for the United States government to pass. The tragedy of Snowden's revelations was to see for how little we threw it all away. But it wasn't merely a single fall. It wasn't merely bad behavior by an administration determined to make hay in crisis time in September in 2001 through February 2002, when all the real harm was done. It was a continuing violation. That is to say, it has become not merely a temporary national security policy or even a national security strategy, it has become a national way of life. That's more than constitutional law is ordinarily called upon to change. And with respect to our movement from a national way of life, which accommodated itself infinitely to enslavement, to a new national way of life which did not, it would be reasonable to say that changes of this scale will often require more than merely some legal judgment. This isn't us accumulating shame, of course. I mean, it's not like what we are doing in discriminating against one of the Abrahamic religions against the others. This is us being proud of ourselves. This is us claiming to be once again fulfilling manifest destiny and making a special role for ourselves in the world. I guess we would describe it as making the world more open and connected. But not even Facebook can do that with a straight face anymore. The recognition of the depth of the prices that have to be paid for doing these things is almost mature enough now that the conversation has to be conducted on an adult basis. This is what we are gaining. This is what we are losing. This is what our values, our principles, our constitutional regime commit us to. This is what we are presently getting away with. What are we going to do about that? If you wanted to litigate a bunch of great First Amendment cases, if that's what you wanted to do with your career, you could find them. You could do that. If what you wanted to do was to try extra-constitutionally to bring these questions to the world, you could do that too. The reason I was doing that in Bombay at 7:30 this morning is that the most important place in the world is there. But that doesn't mean that all other places don't matter. And the American Supreme Court will always matter. Well, I mean, always, for as long as we remain unnuked and powerful in the way we are powerful. It's soft power piggybacking on hard power, isn't it? As indeed all constitutional progress in the United States always was. Because that's really what the First Amendment and all of the Bill of Rights are about. They are the beginnings of the expression of misgivings at the moment that the empire was created. And it's those expressions of misgivings which are the constitutional law that we have and which we use. Not everywhere in the world are constitutional misgivings treated with equivalently reverential recognition that they are part of the soft power of the society, but on the other hand, we are by no means the sole understander of that principle. In this respect, the First Amendment is, as it is claimed to be by the United States in its great moments of self-regard, a light unto the nations. Yes, indeed it is. Yes, that's right, it is. And I would argue that its glory lies in the details of it, including the principle of non-abridgment, and that its virtues are demonstrated by its weaknesses, by its inability to make itself useful throughout the 19th century, by its inability to coexist with slavery. It's not the disgrace of the First Amendment itself that the conflict between the First Amendment and slavery was won by slavery. A lot of stuff was won by slavery until it wasn't. And that principle is also true about the First Amendment in the 21st century. It's not that it insists at gunpoint that it is incompatible with the universal surveillance of civil society. But in the end, it is. And it is for reasons that have to do with all the varied struggles of the 20th century in which it took a part no longer sufficient. Because it will no longer do to talk about the freedom of the New York Times or the Catholic Church or permitted parades. What the net actually does is to open all the various social geometries which the First Amendment then commits government to protecting. Those on the American right who deprecate the existence of something they like to call the rights machine, and who, as with Judge Jackson as she is, Justice Jackson as she will be yesterday, were pursuing these questions of how could one possibly exist on the board of a school which teaches what the school considers to be what should be taught, as though this might mean that this would be a justice untrustworthy when it comes to the possession of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. It's all very, I mean, really quite thrilling in the irony of it. But it's also indicative of what we are about to face. The First Amendment jurisprudence of the later 20th century is very interesting indeed. But looking back from the beginning of the 22nd, the First Amendment jurisprudence of the middle 21st century is going to be far more impressive, whatever it says. Because it is going to have come to grips with new forms of social life, and it is going to have decided what it means for law to be forcibly evicted from a role in abridging those relationships. All of the forms of social life that you can imagine in the net which is far larger than the number of social forms of life that correspond to the needs of the platform companies, or the parasite with the mind of God. All the forms of social life which don't depend upon surveillance yields advertising, yields untold wealth with which to build the technology of further surveillance. That's only one possible relationship between market and economy and state and people. All of the ones one can imagine are in one way or another implicated by the promise that our government will not abridge these freedoms. If we are exercising true social creativity and political dissent in the 21st century America, then the First Amendment must protect those activities. I hope I'm now at least being unreasonable and crazy enough to stimulate a question or an objection. Otherwise, you all just silently signed up for a constitutional revolution based on techno-anarchism. And I really don't think you meant to do that. Surely somebody would ask at least one question to prevent that from happening. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that, and I agree that the net belongs to the people, right?
Well, that would be a conclusion we could try and reach anyway. If we look at how it works right now, we won't come to that conclusion.
But ideally,
right, ideally it does. Yep.
My question is, I would like to know your point of view. Do you believe that that should be achieved through regulation, allowing some private entities to develop their business in the net, or do you think your position is a little more radical?
I don't know, it's less European than that, let me put it that way. If any such condition could be achieved by regulation, the European Union would have at least moved some. But it hasn't, because it can't be achieved that way. In particular with respect to constitutional rights of the kind we're talking about now, because the European regulatory structure always contains explicitly or implicitly at the bottom of the first page a footnote which says none of this applies to our listener. The same European Union broadly whipping up what I would love to believe is real support for real electronic democracy is A, as I say, undemocratic, but B, also the place where the English Investigatory Powers Act and the French Military Platforms and Bill and all sorts of other legislation easily passes national parliaments for the purpose of exempting government power from any of its regulatory improvements. And of course, that really does have a role to play in speaking to possible alternate social futures. I see absolutely nothing wrong with attempting to imagine Islamic governments and democracies in Western Europe, as I see nothing wrong with imagining them here. But nobody is going to allow that imagining to go on in contemporary Europe undisturbed by government listening and government. That's why, at least until a moment ago, the European Union and the Chinese Communist Party had such strong identities of interest that they could do business with one another about almost everything. As they could with Tsar Vladimir, as long as there was gas and oil on one side of the balance. I don't think regulation is the proper outcome, in other words, because I see it failing. I don't believe this is a theoretical proposition. This is a political one. And similarly, although I may be hanging out in the early morning in Bombay or Delhi trying to convince people that on the Indian subcontinent a private future for the world could be made, built, and sold profitably, I don't actually expect that to work. Radical, I guess, is about going to the root of the thing, and in that sense, of course, I always have been rather radical about this, because I've always thought that if we got to the bottom of the technology and actually embedded freedom in it, we could make some progress, and to some extent I think we did. But of course we also enabled the growth of Facebook and all the rest of it, because what we did to change the technology worked to change the technology, but it didn't determine what the technology meant. This is actually a crisis of meaning. This is why I stand here and I put all this, you know, old, threadbare, hoary constitutional and legal history into the mix, because I actually think it's an interpretive matter. I think the more people understand about the context, the more that they can be empowered in the democracy to know what all this stuff should mean, even if they don't know what it does. And I think it, at the level of meaning that the conversation about politics is now beginning to occur. I say beginning because, of course, I spent decades of my life hoping that eventually people in the world would care about this stuff, but knowing that it was way too geeky for the people at the moment, every moment. From trying to talk about it with my father when I was 15 to trying to talk about it with Columbia Law School students at the end of the 20th century, it was just too geeky. Now it's still too geeky if we really want to talk about some of the places where I want to concentrate effort, which is down there in the infrastructure where it works. I am actually more interested in technological solutions than most people. And I'm interested in politics always, because politics, law, and technology are the three legs of the stool always. I can't analyze or understand, let alone begin to solve problems, without all three of them. But I don't think it's the politics of regulation so much as I think it's the politics of meaning definition. Ideology, if you like. How we view the world together and why we do it that way. I'm not exactly a Samuel Huntington clash of cultures type, and I'm not even sure that, like the current president of the United States, I think this is a conflict between autocracy and democracy, because I think they bleed together far too much to make that a neat dichotomy. I'm not even inclined to think that over here is rising China and over here is falling America and everything else is merely in between. But I do think that the confrontation about meaning is oddly far along. Points of view have gotten really clarified now. It is time to teach the people what has been said and to find out what the people want to say next. That's the politics, I think, that matter. The rule book writing? The fundamental problem of the European Union in the present situation is that what it wants to export mostly is regulation. It neither wants to build technology nor to create new meaning. It wants to make rules and make other people follow them by consensus. A good European idea, but not a good way of confronting the current systemic crises, which are not about, do we have enough rules? In this sense, again, European government and Chinese government agree. They want rule by law. That's why rule by law, even rule of law, sometimes isn't enough. Because you wind up with a lot of law, but technology and politics aren't governed by law. They are independent forces, and you must, in the end, bring all of them to bear. One of the things which is happening at the moment, just at the moment, is that Europe is gaining a new influx of highly technically sophisticated people who have just watched what they consider to be a good enough society dissolve beneath them. The role of the Russian exiles in this phase is going to be like the role of the scientific exiles from Middle Europe in the late 30s and early 40s. What those people will bring may be one or another of the pieces of that world. They may be Werner von Braun, too. But we are about to discover another set of people exiled from Hong Kong and exiled from Russia and, of course, bombed out of Ukraine, who are young, technically sophisticated people with a lot of politics, made more urgent by the world in which they lived, and they're going to begin to be in new dialogue with people whose homes they are sharing, and whose societies they are living in, and whose values they are questioning. And that might be ultimately as important as anything the European Commission is going to do this next 2 years, in the middle of its five. Right? Is that responsive? Yeah, okay, thank you then. Yes?
It seems that obviously the response in Russia has been to try to create basically its own, shut off its internet to the extent possible from outside. Do you think, and it seems that based on how, like, that in some sense that's been successful, because they're doing a good job of restricting information in Russia coming in from the outside, do you think that there's a risk of that being sort of intimidated by a lot of other autocracies, and we see sort of further fragmentation? implementation of, I don't know, like a new, like an iron curtain online?
See, I mean, if I try and understand from away, because now we are all away from there, if I try and understand what has happened, I would have said that what Tsar Vladimir actually did was that he tried to collapse the net in order to make television relatively more powerful again, because that's really where he excels. So the effort to lobotomize the Russian internet by removing Instagram, you know how I feel about this, because every single thing he crushes is a thing I wouldn't be caught dead using anyway, right? So from my point of view, if that's really what it means to be in hell, then I live there already, and I think it's fine, and the water's nice, come on in. That's not really, I think, what happened. So it might be later on. I mean, the Great Firewall of China, yeah, I know. But what that really means is that it imposes deeper inequality between those who have access and those who watch television. And it demonstrates once again the power of broadcasting to create worlds of its own. When I wrote in the late 20th century that what we called totalitarianism would better have been described as monarchy with radio, I think it would now be fair to say that Tsar Vladimir is proving that what we call totalitarianism is monarchy, tsardom in fact, with television. Now, if you will give me just a moment on that basis, that what is really happening is that the net is being quieted so that the people who watch television will not be disturbed by their grandchildren, then I think it would be also good to say that this is working like so many of his other devices in this war, way slower and way less effectively than he anticipated. On the other hand, the tool that every human being needs is a ladder that climbs over all firewalls. This is wrongly described most of the time nowadays as virtual private networks. That's wrong. I mean, it's good to have technical vocabulary which makes sense. This thing we call virtual private networking, we ought to call proxy browsing. That is to say, you put a fulcrum somewhere else in the net, and you send all your browsing through it, preferably securely, so that everything you want to read bounces off free territory first. This is a very useful tool. Once it's called a VPN and sold as a service, it becomes a surveillance mechanism of its own. Your secret police can run your VPN services, etc., etc. I should be right now teaching you how every single one of you can have perfect proxy browsing of a secure kind forever. And the reason that I can't is that CUIT took away your power to do that on the 25th of August, and I've been fighting about it ever since. Everybody ought to know how to use a multi-user mainframe-like computer located in some research center or university or other thing around the world to send all your browsing through all the time with a secure backhaul to you so that you can read whatever you want as though you were standing in the middle of Oxford, which is the best possible condition. Up until the 25th of August of last year, Columbia gave you that, and you didn't know it, and they didn't tell you, and when they broke it in the middle of the night and didn't apologize to anybody. And that's not even the most important war I'm fighting about student privacy at the moment around here. But let's just imagine, in other words, that we have actually done one of the simple technical things we ought to have done long since and given everybody everywhere an easy way to climb their ladder over all the walls in between them and whatever it is they want to read. This is technically possible for us. Now suppose we have done that and he has done this. Who wins? The answer is we win. But we don't win for everybody. We win only for the people who are smart, who are technological, who are knowledgeable, or who have a friend who is knowledgeable. Somebody who can help them become part of a culture of understanding of the world which escapes parochial walls and which breaks the ability of states and parties to do this work. Which means, of course, we are subversives, extremists, people who are undermining the security of the state or social stability of the Chinese people or whatever it is. And I have comrades in the world out there in places I don't wish to name right this minute in a tape recorder who have paid with their lives for trying to do simple stuff like this. So we shouldn't regard it as a trivial matter just because it is technologically simple. This is what I think he's opened up. And across most of his 11 time zones, he will be successful because television's all that matters. But in a couple of that time zones, he will fail completely. And that failure may be one of the forces limiting the ability of that czar to survive. I just don't know. I'm not sure that you're trying to know more than can be known, but I still don't know exactly what you want to know.
Well, I think it's like I studied abroad in Russia many, many years ago, and I think a lot of Russians I knew did have VPNs, or what were known as VPNs. And
right.
It was mainly at the time to watch like American Netflix and things like that, play video games, but it does seem among young people in that country there are tools that they're looking at. Obviously, TV is still huge, but it does seem like if you want to get around things, you can't. But you have to be young, you have to see. I think he's sort of inclined to do that already.
You might also be old. It may be that you just didn't hang out with enough people who survived the Soviet Union in particular. Those there, too, I have comrades, like the old and the young, let's say. Okay, so now where can we take that idea from where you left?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was in Irkutsk, so I wasn't exactly in the center of things.
But that's good. Yeah. And?
But I think there is a lot of a low. I mean, it's a very tough to put that gene back in the bottle, so to speak. I don't think we can do it.
Now, this isn't the time for bottling genies. This is the time for surviving the war you started. By the time you're taking senior FSB guys and putting them in jail, you're not trying to put genies back in bottles. This is an existential moment, and it's being treated with the form of sloppy brutality that you would expect an existential moment to be treated with. The caesura in Russian history is far deeper than the caesura in our own. Whatever grand disruptions are going to occur short of full-scale nuclear war, most of them are going to happen to the Russian people. And we don't yet know, as they do not yet know, what that level is going to be. But before I came down here, I was reading about Anatoly Chubais quitting Russian government and leaving the country. And when that has happened, right, the ship is sinking. Not just rats are leaving now. Even great diplomats with only 50% rat quality, rat proportion in them are leaving now. That's important to know. I don't think this is a plan. I think this is an improvisation by power. And it will have unintended consequences, as such things do, only some of which will be death and destruction. But the Soviet Constitution had an excellent First Amendment equivalent, too. What we're really trying to find out is what the human race presently wants and what the human race will presently tolerate. And as you understand, convenience is more important than freedom in answering that question. Other comments? Well, yeah.
Would you consider any VPN provider to be safe today, or at least not?
You don't want to send your packets to people you can't trust for other purposes. And more importantly, you want to make measuring your packets harder. The value of an SSH proxy to some multi-user computer of yours is that you're not even necessarily logged in there. If I had the fulcrum back to put my lever on, then I could teach you in 20 minutes how to do that job way more safely than you can do it by paying a provider to tunnel your packets for you. Because what you really want is to be one among 200 scholars using a machine. What you really want is not to be a subscriber, but to be a student with a right to log into a place, and that's it. And after that, wherever you are in the world, all your packets are moving back and forth between some large packet structure at Columbia called QNIX, let us say, and a little encrypted tunnel, not HTTPS through a browser, for heaven's sake. I mean something stronger. Which leads back to you wherever you are, and which discloses nothing about your location to anybody who can hurt you. The commercial VPN provider fails to achieve at least two of those things. In the first place, it is simply offering HTTPS back and forth, and it can be spoofed, and it can be man in the middle, and all the other things can be done to it that would be harmful. And in the second place, it knows where you are. Then it could also be unreliable. But even if only two of those things have been broken, it's still not a service I want you to use. Then there are the ancillary benefits of proxy browsing through a major university. Did you know that you all have free access to the Oxford English Dictionary? No, you didn't, but you should, because actually it's one of the greatest online assets available, the entire history of the English language. But it's only available by subscription. And a subscription is a campus-wide subscription, and if you're browsing from a Columbia University IP address, then you have free access to the Oxford English Dictionary, even if, after all, you're SSH tunneling in from Mariupol or Sevastopol or Moscow. And that's not just true about the Oxford English Dictionary. The great universities are resources of rights in electronic knowledge, which they want to share as broadly as they can, and which, generally speaking, from a technological point of view, they share from their IP addresses. I'm not outing Dor in any way by pointing out that the Israeli government's approach to all of this for a generation now has been to offer business class so-called service to the global net from Israeli universities and research centers and other intellectual, and all others get economy class international internet service, which of course includes extra listening, just in case. In other words, being able to ventriloquize your location in the net in the direction of some places where academic freedom and academic privilege are both maximized is a pretty good idea. I'll give you an ironic example. My brother published an article once upon a time in a very prestigious history and humanities journal called Past and Present. And the difficulty was that on JSTOR, that great collection of all the academic publications that we all have, which is jointly paid for by all the American universities and research centers, his home institution, Lehigh University, has a second-class subscription to JSTOR. And so he was not allowed to read his own article. This annoyed him, because, of course, it was his own article. And so he rang me to say, what the hell is going on here? And I was in my attic in Amsterdam. And I said, oh, that's not a problem. Because my attic in Amsterdam, of course, is tunneled to the Columbia University IPs, and Columbia has an unrestricted everything all the time, all that you want, subscription to JSTOR, because we're a founding member of the consortium. So he cannot read his article, but sitting in my attic in Amsterdam, tunneling to a mainframe on the Columbia University campus, I press two buttons and it's in his hand. There are more privileges available than merely the ability to climb over walls contained here, which is why I'm so irate that I can't be teaching you this, because you can't just go home and fire up PuTTY and do it using your so-and-so at Columbia.edu account. That's the way a university should work. That's the way we should be making it possible for everybody on this campus to violate the Chinese national security law, absolutely free of any responsibility or likelihood of getting caught, even by the second best team in the world. But we don't. Instead, you get a $15 a month subscription to KGB VPNRUS. I do own the domains kgbmail.net, but I don't own the domains KGB VPNRUS. Maybe I should go and pay that. That might be useful. Was that all of the question, or did you want to follow up?
Not now.
Not now. Later. Okay. Anybody who wants to follow up now? I'm not going to stop with the First Amendment today. I'm going to carry on a little bit next week, so you could think about what it is you want to object to. It's not last chance, going once, going twice. I just wish it were. Anything else? All right, so, yeah.
I don't know.
It's truth.
America is obviously in a proxy war with Russia right now, by way of Ukraine.
Well, yeah, by way of the Romanians and the Poles and Ukraine. That is Russia. To say, we're even further back.
In any event, my question is, at least from your perspective, what barometer do you use to measure that we'll receive?
Well, you know, right. I mean, at one level, that's a media diet question, right? At one level, that's how much beyond the New York Times and the Washington Post, to the Guardian and Le Monde, and the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung, and so on, would you need to go in order to follow this war in a way which is more truthful? But the other thing we have to point out is that for all that Tsar Vladimir has spent an awful lot of time eradicating the truth for the Russian population, he has spent almost no time eradicating the truth from the Western populations. If he had indeed crushed the domestic networks of Ukraine, if Volodymyr Zelensky had no way to get his messages out, if we didn't actually have all sorts of citizen journalism inside every smart-ass phone in terrain, if we didn't have an enormous amount of powerful media collection and reportage, which has cost the lives of some Western journalists, including people working for Rupert Murdoch, if we didn't have all that, then truth would be even harder to find than it is now. The fog of this war is surprisingly unfoggy. It's yet another part of the surprise about this. The truth is that fog is hard. This is the point we were discussing just a couple of minutes ago. I'll match you cliche for cliche. My friend and comrade since I was 16 and he was 19, John Gilmore, said once about a quarter of a century ago that the internet regards censorship as failure and routes around it. This came to be known as Gilmore's Law. It was a kind of hopeful American libertarianism that the net in and of itself would avoid its own suppression. And like the principle that the first casualty of war is truth, it isn't quite true, but it's sort of true. And now we are watching the way in which Gilmore's Law is sort of true, even under conditions as radically, brutally suppressive as the Russian war in Ukraine. You won't be surprised that the Chinese Communist Party's fog machinery is way better than Tsar Vladimir. It has to work constantly over 1.4 billion people. It comprehensively does that in a world in which television is by no means comparatively powerful with respect to the web. It manages to do that by a process which is both capital and labor intensive and which dwarfs anything that Tsar Vladimir is doing. He has nuclear weapons, but he doesn't have that. He has troll armies. He has misinformation factories. He has brutes and boots all over the place. But he hasn't managed to create anywhere near as much fog as the Chinese Communist Party can do over one Yangtze tourist boat that sinks. They can turn unreality into reality in ways that Tsar Vladimir has been unable to do. And where they want to march their boots, more quiet follows than follows his. So I'm not sure which way to treat the relationship between the cliché and the reality. Your suggestion that this is complicated and not so clear is really right from my point of view. This is a lesson, again, in the difficulties of the organization of an information order on the fly using violence. Part of what the Chinese Communist Party wishes to export, it's not part of Belt and Road, it's a different part of its a global development strategy, is to sell information control by surveillance and intervention to other society. It's a product for export. And as a product for export, it's also pretty impressive. And yet, exporting it doesn't make it work. And places to which they sold a whole lot of surveillance and manipulation machinery, Ecuador, Peru, other societies around the world have not been able to achieve the power of bending reality that they exercise using the same machinery. Less capital, less labor, but also less isolation from the remainder of the world through linguistic and cultural self-importance. That's a required part of this story. And Tsar Vladimir, for all that he may wish to take the Russian world off into space, that Russian world is not amputatable from the society of the rest of the universe. That's the great problem of Russian cultural and political history, the inevitable balancing between Slavophiles and Westernizers, as we were taught to call them when we studied the subject. There's just no way to rip it loose. Eurasia, a thing of its own, doesn't work. And isn't working now, right at that line of boundary between Europe and Eurasia, which it is the constant effort of Russian power to move back and forth. The problem of this thing is that it's happening right now, right now. Bombs are dropping on the heads of my friends and former students and comrades, and ordnance was put between two signs that read children. And when that is happening, we are not able to think slowly either. But to think slowly about this is to be learning an awful lot, some of which is highly difficult to reconcile with what we thought was true. And with respect to information war, I think that's particularly our problem right now. What is happening is hard to interpret in the pre-existing assumptions we were making about what information war would be like in what was then the future and is now our now. Okay, yeah.
I had a question regarding the convenience of smartphones and how that relates to, I guess, also the power in people's hands to now document everything. Because earlier in class, when we talked about just giving up our rights for smartphones, it sounded really bad. But when I'm thinking about it in terms of, there will be some governments in some portion of the world that are going to be using force to disrespect any rights that people are still actively fighting for. And if we move the war zone from away from the technological war to just like a regular war, then doesn't having these tools of convenience also make it more accessible for the average person to at least fight more effectively back against these armies?
Well, I mean, once again, I don't want to make Dor appear as though he comes from a different part of the world, but NSO exists in a different part of the world, all right? This is okay until we begin to think about the actual cyber arms trade. Because you can be as right as you please about the importance of citizen journalism, but if every one of those phones is also an improvised explosive device that can be triggered remotely by somebody else, then we really have to begin to do some hard thinking of the same kind that institutional press have to do when they deal with the secret police of autocratic states where they serve, right? I mean, you have to go along to get along to some extent if you want to file the story. You can't let them torture you to death first. And you're right that we in civil society need ways for people to collect information about others' behavior, but we can't necessarily accept that the way we do that is we collect information about others' behavior while all our information is being collected automatically all the time. Most journalists would refuse that deal outright and would regard themselves as ethically obliged to do that. If I am accredited as a journalist from country Y to country X, and when I arrive and show my visa, they say, great, excellent, here's your spying device. Don't ever go anywhere without it. We're going to listen to everything you do, and we're going to keep track of everything you're going to do, and if you stop wearing it around your ankle, the thugs will be here immediately. Most journalists would feel that they could not actually operate, not that it would be not ethical or professionally practicable to report under those circumstances. Sending amateurs to report under those circumstances is not more acceptable. It's not. So then we have to ask whether the problem is that the equipment is poisoned. And, of course, you know what my answer is. Yes, the equipment is poison. The hardware itself and the software stack itself and its sideband chip's relation to the electromagnetic spectrum itself and the forms of encryption it doesn't and doesn't use their cells are all demonstrations of the fact that we have to carry a different camera. We can't report this story. Which is a perfectly understandable thing for journalists to conclude. But that makes it really, really hard for me to accept that what we're going to do is have citizen journalism based on smartphones and it's going to save us. I have comrades in Bahrain who were tortured because they took an iPhone to a demonstration. Now, it's true that if they hadn't taken the smartphone to the demonstration, we might not have gained one or two photographs of people standing on the Pearl Byway in Bahrain, but that wasn't worth getting people tortured. All of this cuts both ways, exactly.
These Russian generals were using...
Yes, 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 I know. I quite agree. There's no doubt whatever that having the other side carrying the mobile phones is a really good idea. One of my former students, later the dean of the Tel Aviv University faculty, Ron Charis, when we were all younger, Ron, whose permanent association throughout his Miluim life was with a tank brigade on the Golan, Ron was very conscious of the time when his soldiers on the Golan in active reserve all started using their mobile phones to order pizza from Domino's to be driven up to them on the heights. And in Damascus, there were a bunch of guys listening to those mobile phones and watching those Domino's deliveries and planting their little flags up there day by day as the soldiers on reserve moved around and Domino's delivered to them where they were. If you ask me, yes, I would always prefer the other army to be carrying smartphones. There's no doubt about that. But here we were dealing with this other problem, which is that in between the armies, there are the people trying to survive and the people trying to witness, and the people trying to record, and the people trying to collect evidence of war crime, and all of those people are little dots on everybody else's markers running around all the time, and that we have to be afraid of. We do. The last time I was called upon to move around in Beirut, I felt deeply grateful that I wasn't carrying any little device that told anybody where I was. And that would have made my life feel radically insecure to me, let us say. Of course, that is a Beirut which ceased to exist long ago, except that the Beirut which replaced it has also ceased to exist. I would like to correct the technology. I would like to use simpler, cheaper hardware that doesn't contain a whole lot of stuff for spying on you. And I would like it to contain simpler and less complicated software whose job it is to help you to communicate securely and to give as little away of you as possible. And I would like to put that in a thing as cheap as a $40 phone, not as expensive as a $1,000 phone. And then I would like everybody to have that. And guess what? It will still have a camera in it. Because the camera is not the hard part. We are now over time, officially, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't follow up. Go ahead.
Why do you think there hasn't been any mention in the American press except to trivialize the point that the Chinese and Russians have pointed out that there have been biological weapons research centers in Ukraine?
I think the reason the American press hasn't reported it is that they can't confirm it. They operate under, I need two sources and I really need to believe them. Highly controversial stuff like that. And no matter what they do, they can't find two sources that will tell them this. Which might be because it's really, really well hidden, or it might be because it really, really doesn't exist. But if you're an editor in an American publication that thinks of itself as following the journalistic rules, you won't touch it either way because it's really, really important to get it right and you can't confirm it. I think that's what's going on. The guys I know who follow this question certainly are in that position. They don't have any way of confirming these statements. If somebody was doing that, then that was a really interesting thing to do. And the people who would be most pissed off about it live in Germany and are important. Because if they thought that the American government was developing prohibited weapons, criminalized by treaty, in a backyard close to them outside NATO, they would go ballistic. You think the chancellor complains when they're listening to her cell phone? Imagine what he now does if they're developing prohibited weapons forbidden by all international law down the street and around the corner on a vacant lot that the Germans don't control. Oh, that makes them furious. Now, it may be that the United States government has been actually doing that. Mind you, when they wanted to have secret torture prisons in those places, they told those governments about it. They weren't willing to risk having that come out. So the principle we have to believe is that the Americans had a good reason for doing that, so good that they would have been willing to drive a sharpened stick into the eye of their most valuable allies, and they went and did it anyway, and nobody found out about it. And even now we can't confirm that. Now, I will say, we did stuff in Indochina, which is very far from that. But the people all around in Indochina weren't people who cared much about pissing off. We thought we owned them already. That's not the case in Western or East Central Europe. I would say this is an extraordinary claim and it requires extraordinary evidence and we haven't seen it. I think that's what's going on. Which doesn't tell us what the truth is, but it tells us what you asked, which is why is the press silent? Because the press isn't sure. Okay, we're out of time, but office hours are now, so if you want to keep talking to me, we just need to wend our way upstairs. Thanks.
That's a good question.